Good evening. This is Life Rattle, your story show, and I'm your host, Virginia Ashbery. Tonight, Life Rattle number 1226 features two stories from a new Life Rattle writer, Zinat Mohammed. Zinat Mohammed was born the eldest of three children in 1963 in Nairobi, Kenya. Zinat immigrated to Toronto to complete her last year of high school and then attended university. After earning her degree, Zinat worked for the airline industry and then switched careers. She completed a second degree and now works as an English as a second language instructor for adults. She is married with two daughters. Zinat enjoys traveling and reading and has developed a passion for gardening. The stories you will hear tonight come from two different times in our writer's life. We'll start with her childhood at school in Kenya, being tormented by a nasty phys ed teacher who seems to delight in tossing kiddies into the deep end of the pool. In her second story, Zinat fast forwards to her adult life in Toronto, working at Pearson, under pressure, but holding her own with grace, understanding, and humor. Then there is a dead guy who needs to catch a plane. You're listening to Life Rattle from Toronto, Ontario, Canada, and please be advised, Life Rattle stories often contain language and situations that some listeners may find offensive, so listener discretion is advised. So let's listen now as Zinat Mohammed reads her first story tonight. It's titled, The Swim Teacher.
The Swim Teacher by Zinat Mohammed. Wednesday, March 8th, 1972, Nairobi, Kenya. The 11 a.m. bell rings at the Kenya Primary School. The sound pierces my eardrums. The bell signals students in my grade 4 class should get ready for swim class. We 8-year-olds swim for period 3 on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. Ali jumps out of his seat. Serena runs to the front of the classroom. Wilson shrieks. Karima mutters, "I'm not swimming." I reach down for my swim bag. My hand hits the floor. "Oh no," I think to myself. Did I leave my swim bag on the bus? Did I forget it at home? Did I drop it on the way to class? But I don't think about it too much right now. If I fess up, I will have to face the consequences. My teacher will send me to the office. Mr. Wally, or Ginger, as some of the older students call him, is a big, muscular man with an olive complexion and shoulder-length, light brown hair. I guess that's why he got the nickname Ginger. Mr. Wally wears a velour shirt with white pants. He doesn't really teach us anything. He just yells at us from the sidelines and throws us into the deep end of the pool, whether some of us can swim well or not. He ties a rope around the waist of those who can't swim. He holds one end of the rope and tosses the student into the pool. When they struggle, he pulls them out. Mr. Wiley once pushed me off the edge of the topmost diving board as I was deciding whether or not to jump. He ordered me up the white iron stairs. I lifted a knee and placed my foot on the first step and climbed. "Faster," Mr. Wiley yelled. I passed the 3-meter diving board. "Keep climbing," he screamed. I reached the 5-meter diving board, stood at the edge and looked ahead. Mount Kenya stared at me through a blue sky, and I stared back. I then looked down. Heads bobbed in the water below. The water rippled. I could read the words "deep end" on the bottom of the pool, painted in black, lettering that appeared so large on the ground and now looked so small. I faltered. I shifted my weight from one foot to the other. My toes now hung over the edge. I glared into the water below. His hand pushed against my back, sending me over and down. My feet broke the surface of the water. My body followed, and then my head. I went down, 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 until my feet touched the bottom of the 8-foot-deep pool before I came up again. Chlorinated water filled my mouth and my nose. I swam to the edge of the pool. My teacher laughed. Mr. Wally also once tossed Annie into the pool with a rope around her waist. Annie can't swim at all. She tugged and tugged on the rope until she finally yanked him into the pool, white pants and all. He held onto the rope, pulled her up, and then carried her out of the pool. The class laughed, but that was probably the only time we ever laughed in swim or gym class. "What's the matter?" asks Shaheen, who sits next to me. "I don't have my swim stuff," I tell her. "Do you want me to write you a note?" She has the neatest writing in the school. "You think we can get away with it?" "Sure," she says. "No one will know my parents didn't write the note, I think." "Sure," I say, "let's give it a try. But I hope I don't get into even more trouble." Shaheen writes the note on the cleanest piece of paper she can find. "Dear Mr. Wally, please excuse Zeenat from swimming today as she's not well. Sincerely, Mrs. Muhammad." I take the note, I fold it in four, and place it in the pocket of the green tunic that I wear as part of my uniform. The class lines up in the hallway. When everyone has their swim bags, we march through the hallway to a brick wall that encloses the outdoor pool. I take my place at the end of the line and drag my feet until we get to the pool. We enter the pool area through a black wrought iron gate. Everyone who swims runs to get changed. The rest of us stand against the brick wall. We wait to be questioned. Mr. Wally interrogates each of us in turn. "Why are you not swimming?" he asks in his big, deep voice. "I'm not well, sir," I say. "Do you have a note?" I reach into my pocket and slowly and reluctantly hand him the note. He unfolds it. His eyes pierce mine. "Did you write this note yourself?" Mr. Wally asks. "No, sir," I say. "Did you write this yourself?" he yells. "No, sir," I repeat. My voice gets softer as his gets louder. "Is this your handwriting?" "No, sir," I say. "Who wrote this note?" I don't respond. "Can you hear me? Who wrote this note?" he asks again. I tremble. I bite my nails. "If you won't tell me who wrote this note, you will need to go to the headmaster's office." I stare at the hot stone floor. "Go to the headmaster's office right now." I try to find my face in my polished, shiny black shoes. Tears blur my vision. I have done the unthinkable. Now I have to go and give an explanation to the headmaster. I walk back through the gate. Teardrops fall one by one onto my shoes and onto the ground. I've heard horror stories about students who had been struck with a cane by the headmaster, a cane about 3 feet long and half an inch thick. I can't go back. Each step feels heavier than the last. The headmaster's office is the last in a set of 3 interconnected offices. His office sits across the hall from my class. On my way, I peek inside the window of my classroom to see if anyone has stayed behind. Someone I can talk to. I hope someone can save me. The knob doesn't turn, and no one is there anyway. I continue on my way to the office. The secretary works in the first office. She's short and skinny. She has a large nose on a scrawny face. Her shoulder-length jet black hair is puffed up on top of her head. I watch as she types away on a typewriter. The keys sound hard to push. I stand there. I look outside. The rose bushes bordering the empty playground tap on her window. I stand there. A couple of minutes later, she notices me. She looks up at me from above her glasses. "Can I help you?" she asks. I sputter. I choke. I sniff. "Sit down for a moment," she says. She continues to type. I hear a little ding. She holds the handle at the top of the typewriter and pushes it back to the other side. I sit down and try to calm myself. I wipe my tears with the sleeve of my white shirt. When I think I can speak without sobbing, I tell her, "Mr. Wally sent me to see the headmaster." "And why did he send you to the office?" she asks. I explain what happened. I wipe my face with my sleeve. "Mr. Jaggs is in a meeting right now. You'll have to wait," she says. "It could be a while." I hope no one sees me in the office. What would they think of me? I wonder whether the school will call my parents and let them know what I have done. The 11:45 bell rings. The swim period ends. In a few minutes, my classmates will return to the classroom. I wonder what I will say to them. I wonder what I will answer if anyone asks where I had gone. Sounds of students fill the corridor. The secretary finishes typing another line. She looks up at me again. "Go back to your class," she tells me. I peek through the doorway. When I see my classmates clustered outside the classroom door, I slip into the crowd. I enter with everyone else and sit down at my desk. I get my blue math textbook from the shelf in my desk, and like my classmates, I wait for Mrs. Kamau to come back to class. The double bell rings. "Time to go home," Ali yells. I stuff my books into my backpack. I cram my pencil case into the side pocket and squeeze my lunch bag that still holds my sandwich into the top of the backpack and force it closed. I run down the corridor, take a sharp left, and exit the school. I wait with my friends Shaheen, Nimet, and Nilofer in the front driveway for my father. As soon as Dad pulls up, I jump into the car, shut the door, and wave goodbye.
That was The Swim Teacher, written and read by Zinat Mohammed. Our second and last story for tonight is called Mr. Jean-Baptiste. So let's hear that one now.
Mr. Jean-Baptiste by Zinat Mohammed. I scan my employee card, 5:55 a.m. I turn around and say ZM to the manager. I wait for him to assign my work area. "Migrant farm workers check-in," he tells me. I walk down to the international section of the airport terminal building. I pass the lineups for passengers flying to Montreal and New York and see 200 or so farm workers lined up to return home after the end of the harvest season. They wait as I open the doors to the check-in area and then push through their carts that hold oversized bags, boxes, bicycles, and tires. They wear brand new designer clothing, baseball caps, and brand name running shoes. I open the door and they walk in. They line up and wait their turn to check in. A passenger lays his bag on my scale, 97.3 pounds. "Your bag is too heavy, sir," I inform him. I take out, assemble, tape up, and hand the man a cardboard box. I can assemble boxes within seconds now. I ask him to take some stuff out of his suitcase and place it in the box. "Come back when you're done," I say. "Don't wait in the line." He complies and heads to the far corner filled with open suitcases, cardboard boxes, and empty plastic bags. When he returns, I don't charge him the excess baggage fee. He doesn't have that much. "Gate 101, please be there by 7:45, I say. "Thank you very much, lady," he responds. I look over the line. "Next, please," I announce. Another oversized black suitcase, 127.3 pounds. 7:30 a.m., I go on break. I walk over to Tim Hortons and meet Lynn along the way. "Where are you working?" I ask. "Transporter check-in," she replies. "You?" "International. Migrant farm workers." "I feel sorry for you." "I don't mind," I say. "I know they have a lot of stuff. They work hard, and they want to take things back for their families. I wonder if they save any money to take back. They always buy so much." "Yeah, I think the bikes and stuff they're able to sell over there." I look at my watch. I stand up, finish the last sip of my coffee, pop the last bit of bagel into my mouth, and put my wrappers in the bin. I walk out of Tim Hortons. My manager pages me. I go to his little office. "Transporter check-in needs help," he explains. "Can you go?" "Sure," I say. I find a workstation and log onto a computer. A passenger checking in at the counter next to mine complains he's been waiting in line for 10 minutes. Another yells that he missed his flight. Yet another argues with a customer service agent that he wants a free upgrade to business class. Some passengers fill out declaration forms, others squeeze through the lineups with boarding passes printed at home. A woman runs in through the doors. She walks up to the special assistance counter and yells, "I need a wheelchair." Phyllis, who is on wheelchair duty, pushes a wheelchair to the sidewalk. She walks to the passenger side of a brown Honda, opens the door, and extends her arm to help the passenger out. The woman runs around, pushes Phyllis aside, and insists on lifting the passenger into the chair herself. "I'll do this," the woman says. "You hold the chair." Phyllis, a customer service agent in her 60s, wears her hair straight across her forehead and straight across her neck. Her big, black, square glasses contrasts with her round face. Phyllis shuffles as she pushes the baggage cart, and the woman rolls the passenger in. The passenger's head lops to one side, almost resting on his shoulder. Phyllis brings in his ticket to the counter. Marie checks him in. "Any baggage?" Marie asks. "One," the woman replies. "Are you the passenger?" "No, I'm not. My brother is traveling. He's not well." "Where is he?" Marie asks. "Right here in the wheelchair." Marie looks over to him. "Can I see his passport?" The woman hands Marie a Haitian passport for Mr. Jean-Baptiste and a ticket for flight 714 to New York. Marie checks it over and gives the woman the boarding pass. The woman kisses her brother goodbye, and then Phyllis takes over. She places Mr. Jean-Baptiste's carry-on bag on the conveyor at security. A security guard waves them through. "Okay," he says. A U.S. immigration officer asks, "Mr. Jean-Baptiste, how long have you been in Canada?" Mr. Jean-Baptiste's head hangs over his shoulder. "How long have you been in Canada, Mr. Jean-Baptiste?" The officer looks at the ticket, the boarding pass, and the passport. "Mr. Jean-Baptiste, where are you traveling to?" The officer comes around and walks in front of and then around Mr. Jean-Baptiste. "Sir, can you look at me?" He takes Mr. Jean-Baptiste's hand. "Sir? Sir, Mr. Jean-Baptiste." "John, come over here," he says to another officer. "Take a look at this guy." John puts his hand on Mr. Jean-Baptiste's black jacket and nudges him. "He looks a little green to me. Take a look. His eyes are glassed over and they're not moving. They're like popping out," John says. "Shit, he's dead." The officer then touches Mr. Jean-Baptiste's forehead. "Stone cold," he says. "This guy's been dead for a while." "I thought something was wrong," says Phyllis. If there's a doctor in the terminal building, would you kindly come to the U.S. check-in area? The officer pages. The immigration officer picks up a black phone at his station and calls for an ambulance. He then pages the RCMP. I walk behind Phyllis as I escort another passenger. Can you please stay with me, she pleads. I'm so scared. I'll walk this passenger to the gate and I'll be right back, I tell her. I switch lines, get my passenger to the gate, and return to Phyllis's side. The paramedics arrive and administer CPR. No chance, one says. He's been gone a while. The RCMP arrives. An officer reaches into Mr. Jean-Baptiste's pocket. He finds a U.S. resident alien card in the name of Alain Jean-Baptiste and an Ontario health insurance plan card in the name of Murphy Blakely. Who brought this passenger to the airport? The RCMP officer asks. Some woman, Phyllis replies. I think it was his sister. We need her contact info, the officer tells her. Phyllis hands over the documents to the RCMP. They ask us to leave. The next day, the lunchroom is abuzz with the news that someone had checked in a dead passenger. Oh yes, I heard he had a phony health card, Mike says. I read something about it in the paper, Jan adds. The cops called his sister in. She apparently took him from the hospital. He was undergoing treatment for AIDS and wasn't doing well. She couldn't afford to ship his body back. She's being charged for illegally trying to transport a dead passenger. I walk towards the check-in area, sign into a workstation, raise my hand and say, "Next in line, please."
You've just heard Mr. Jean-Baptiste, written and read by Zinat Mohammed. And that concludes Life Rattle number 1226. I recorded Zinat Mohammed reading her stories. My name is Virginia Ashbery. Life Rattle returns next Thursday night with more stories. And Life Rattle is produced from Toronto and was created by Guy Allen and Arnie Ackman.